This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In his new book, psychiatrist Lance Dodis gets right to the point on page one. He writes, Alcoholics Anonymous was proclaimed the correct treatment for alcoholism 75 years ago, despite the absence of any scientific evidence, and we have been on the wrong path ever since. He says each year, state and federal governments spend billions of dollars on 12-step programs, even though they almost always fail.
It's quite a critique of an approach and an industry that millions of Americans embrace, if not swear by. Consider that just last week, Governor Deval Patrick declared an opiate abuse, a public health crisis in Massachusetts, and committed $20 million to increasing drug treatment services, much of which will be spent on 12-step programs.
But Lance Dodis says 12-step programs are not only useless, they can be harmful. He's a member of the Boston Psychoanalytical Society and Institute and a recently retired assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is called The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Behind 12-Step Programs in the Rehab Industry, which he co-wrote with Zachary Dodis. And Dr. Dodis, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
It's a fascinating critique, and we want to say at the top that we did invite a representative of Alcoholics Anonymous to come on the program and participate in this conversation. They decline. But listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Do you find 12 steps helpful, the 12-step programs helpful? Have you been involved in a 12-step program? What works? What doesn't? Are you looking for alternatives? Join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Lance Dodis, let's get right to your bottom line. For the millions of people who attend regular meetings, how effective are 12-step programs?
Well, they have about a 5 to 10% success rate. So I wouldn't say that they are useless for everybody. They're useful for 5 to 10%. And the problem with it is not those people who, by the way, should stay in AA if they're doing well. The problem is that the other 90% of the people who are referred to AA, and that is almost everyone with an addiction, are being hurt by being sent to a program that can't possibly help them. And besides wasting time doing that, there are many other things that they could be trying, which they are discouraged from doing because AA, even though the individual people in AA may be kind and compassionate, AA itself is never wrong, according to AA.
If you're when you say it's never well, wrong, you mean it's not the fault of the program if people aren't doing well in it, right?
Exactly. People are told, if you're not doing well, you have to work harder, work the program harder, go to more meetings, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Hmm. And that would make sense if it made a difference to go more. But in fact, that isn't the way it works. It simply doesn't work for most people. So to encourage them to return suggests that if they're not doing well, it's their fault. It's not AA's fault. Incidentally, that's the same problem that the rehabs have, and we all believe it. When celebrities go in and out of these expensive rehabs, we blame them. We say, seventh, eighth admission, what's wrong with these people? They're not staying with the program. But no one says, maybe the treatment is lousy, which is much closer to the truth.
Well, let me just ask you a little bit about the numbers, and just so that I can get my head around them. AA self-reports figures that are much better than the ones you cite, and I want to ask you about those. They claim that 24% of their members are sober for 1 to 5 years, 12% sober 5 to 10 years, 33% of members said they are sober for more than a decade. So those numbers sound pretty good, or better.
Well, they certainly do sound better. One of the reasons that we wrote the book is that we wanted to look at the people who had scientifically looked at this and see what they said. There are some articles that suggest that AA has should be recommended. So we looked very closely at those. And here's what we found. There are three main problems with the studies that suggest the kind of results that you're talking about. One is methodological. Almost all of these studies make their conclusions on the basis of self-reports. So if you've been in AA or in some treatment for a long time, they call you up or they send you a questionnaire and they ask you, how are you doing? Self-reports are notoriously inaccurate. The people who do well are usually glad to tell you, but the people who are not doing well don't return the questionnaire. And this is well known and actually acknowledged in the literature. But that's one problem. A second problem is that the studies that are the most cited in favor of AA commit a cardinal sin in science, which is that they ignore data that doesn't fit their conclusion. In what I'm referring to is the fact that there are always enormous dropout rates in these studies, as the AA data suggests, by the way, that AA itself acknowledges that 75% of their people drop out in the first year. We have a lot of other data to suggest that. When you throw those people out of your study, and again, these are the people who we know did the worst, and you look only at the people who remained, you're going to get a biased sample. So all the people who say, as your AA quote suggests, that if you've been in AA for 10 years, you're doing well, that's probably true. But practically no one stays in AA for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Those are the 5 to 10% people. So it's a logical error, and the conclusion that these people draw, which is, since these people are doing well, having stayed a long time, everyone should try to stay a long time. It's circular. The fact is, people don't stay a long time because it's not helping them. And well, suggesting that they stay longer is a mistake.
I'm really curious about this. Given what you've written here and back up in a really convincing way, how did AA gain such a place of privilege in America's health culture? I mean, so many people believe in it. I feel like it's almost an article of faith in America right now, that it works.
I think that is exactly the right way to describe it. It is an article of faith. In the 1930s, when AA first began to be established and when the big book came out, almost all of the medical folks who looked at it thought it was garbage, including the American Medical Association. 10 years later, in the 1940s, they had completely reversed themselves, and the AMA was endorsing it. In 1951, AA was awarded a Lasker Prize for its wonderful contribution to public health. In fact, there was no science that changed between the 30s and the 40s. There was no science at all, actually. So what changed? This was the result of people like Marty Mann and, of course, Bill Wilson, who founded AA, having fabulous marketing skills and making connections, especially Marty Mann, with some very important people. The Rockefeller family, for example, helped to give money to support the publication of AA. And a large number of institutions became imbued with the AA idea without any proof. Once it got established, it remained. And that is true to this day. If you look at state government agencies charged with addiction treatment, including Massachusetts, which I'm familiar with, you'll find that they're filled with AA people. So you're not going to get a scientific or a neutral hearing about what to do.
Yeah. Dr. Dodas, I'd love to get some listeners into this conversation. We've already got a bunch who are calling in. And just to bring you all up to date, we're talking to Dr. Lance Dodas. He's a retired assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Med School. He's been treating people with addictions for more than three decades, and he's author of The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Behind 12-Step Programs in the Rehab Industry. Let's take a call. Linda is calling from Watertown. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that as a member of AA, I never lost a job. I never bankrupted my family, but I know plenty of people who have done both of those things and worse. And AA, in my opinion, has never pretended to be a science. All they say is, if you really want to stop, this is a way that you can stop. And it's not for people who need it. It's only for people who want it. And I can tell you that I went to decades of meetings and never felt any better until I, you know, I'm sure the doctor will just blow this off and say that it's ridiculous. But, you know, until I went to meetings that pulled apart the big book of AA and said, and I did the actual work. I wrote down everything. I, you know, went and talked to somebody else. I went and got a relationship with God. And, this is a spiritual thing. I'm completely a-religious otherwise. Yeah. All I know is now I feel good. I used to feel bad.
Well, Linda, I'm really glad that it's worked for you. And I would like Dr. Dodas to respond to what you said. Dr. Dodas, there's Linda who's saying it works for her and that AA has never made the claim that it's scientific. It just helps people.
Well, I'm also glad it works for her, and I've never denied that it works for some people. That's the 5 to 10%. That's fine. As far as a claiming that it's scientific, AA doesn't claim that it's scientific, but that doesn't mean we can't apply science to it. It would be unnecessary to apply any outside measure if it were a private organization that didn't affect public health. But it has become part of our society. People are court mandated to go to AA, even though the courts have in 25 states have decreed that to be unconstitutional because AA is legally a religious institution in those states. So, you know, the fact that it is not scientific doesn't mean we can't study it and learn what its success rate is and that we should change our whole system so we're not referring 100% of people to it.
Mm. And I want to talk to you about sort of how the, you know, what the best way would be to change the system. But let me just sort of stick with Linda's call just for a moment, because even if it's just helping 5 to 10% of people, what explains that success? I mean, can you, in other words, as someone who has treated people with addiction, can you explain at least how it helps 5 to 10% of people who sign up?
Oh, sure. And we're quite, I've long been interested in that. There's a chapter in the book on this, too. It turns out, and there are some studies about this, it turns out that the 12 steps themselves actually are not the most important part. AA is correct when it describes itself as a fellowship. Mainly, it's the camaraderie and the support and the structure of AA that help people. And that's what most people, if you interview them, the people who are doing well, that's what they mostly describe. When people were asked about the individual steps, they got a much more varied response. The majority of people said they were off-put, that's their term, by all the references to God, which are, you know, shot through the 12 steps. The one step that was most endorsed was step four, which is taking what AA calls a fearless moral inventory. The moral part should be left out, of course, but the idea of trying to understand yourself is sensible for anyone and is part of any good therapy. So I think that it's mostly the camaraderie.
Mm.
But there's something else to be said, which is there are some people who I think have psychologically can make use of the higher power idea. And this gets to what I've been writing about for the past couple of decades about how addiction works. If addiction is a way of dealing with feelings of overwhelmingly helpless, as I believe, then you can see how having a higher power would be helpful for that. But it only works for some people. For most people, naturally, a problem as serious, a symptom as serious as compulsive drinking can't be resolved by being in a fraternity. But there are a few people for whom that's becomes deeply important.
Mm. Can I ask you about another principle? And I'm obviously, I mean, not obviously, I'm talking to you about this as someone who hasn't been in a 12-step program, so I'm really talking to you as an outsider. But this idea that people sort of proclaim that they are powerless in the face of their addiction. I have talked to many heroin addicts, for example, and had them describe their addiction to me, and they do talk about this idea that they are powerless in the face of this addiction, and AA and these 12-step programs seem to speak to that in a way that is very significant. Is there another sort of part of treating the addict that needs to be considered here?
Oh yes, actually, a lot of people who can't make use of AA. Deeply resent step one, which is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol or over our addiction. The problem with it is that first of all, it's not quite true. I mean, I know what they mean, of course, but the solution to it is not to acknowledge powerless for most people. It's to be empowered. It's to find a way to deal with it, which is how we deal with almost every emotional or, for that matter, physical problem in the world. You want to find a way to exert power over what you haven't been able to have power over. The powerless idea is really just a step on the way towards saying, now we need to have a higher power. You know, you have to remember that Bill Wilson was a member of something called the Oxford Group, which was a fundamentalist Christian group. He later left it, but he said that AA was founded on the basis of the Oxford Group, and it's taken entirely from those principles. And that central principle is the problems of mankind are caused by being at a distance from God. So we need to get closer to God in order to solve our problems. And that's the 12-step idea. Mm-hmm. You know, turn your power over to a higher power. You know, there's nothing wrong with it inherently. It's just that it isn't that effective for most people. And as I say, many people are discouraged by the idea that they have to admit they're powerless.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Leominster. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
All right. I, like the previous caller, am a sober member of a 12-step program. Unlike her, my life was a train wreck before I got sober. I had lost my job. I was divorced. I had been kicked out of my house, living in a rooming house. So things were very bad for me. I went to several rehabs. I was introduced to 12-step programs there. Attended a number of 12-step meetings for, in fact, about 3 years before I finally got sober. And I have to say that I would agree entirely with your guest that scientific principles need to be applied to the 12-step programs. But I would also agree with the previous caller who said there's something there that's working. And I have to say that the 12 steps, to me, provide this framework for self-examination and, you know, finding the root cause. And while some people may be able to gain that through therapy, a lot of people who come into the various 12-step programs, they're destitute, they're broken, and they don't have access to a therapist, and they also don't have the peer-to-peer relationship that they would with other alcoholics or addicts. In the 12-step programs, they can relate better, and they can see that... if nothing else, there is hope because there are all these people who have succeeded where they feel that they're helpless and hopeless.
Sure, Tom, I'm really glad you called in. Thanks so much. Dr. Dotus, let me talk to you about Tom's call. And we have literally only a minute left, and I'm sorry we don't have more time. But
okay,
I sort of wanted to shift the focus for the final minute and just talk about if not AA, then what? I mean, if not the 12-step programs, then what? I mean, what's your best recommendation?
Well, there are a number of other things people can do. And unlike the AA official stance, I would never claim that my approach is the best for everyone or that people shouldn't try other things. AA doesn't refer anyone out, you know. But what I've found useful for my patients is to understand addiction as a psychological symptom. That is that addictive acts are never random. They occur after people feel overwhelmed and trapped. So what they are actually are an attempt to be re-empowered against this helplessness. It works because at the moment that people decide to, say, have a drink, they already don't feel helpless. And people regularly describe that they feel better at that moment. So you can look into it. I've written a couple of books about it, and I think there are a number of other ways that people should try.
Well, Dr. Lance Dotus, it's a really interesting read and a really provocative set of ideas and research as well. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Lance Dotus. He's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytical Society and Institute. And he's the author of The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Behind 12-Step Programs and the Rehab Industry. Stay with us. There's more to come on our program. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.